Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
All right, so today we're going to talk about antipsychotic drugs. Before I begin, how many people here have taken psychopathology? A couple of you? Okay. Because I'm going to do some background on what schizophrenia is, and why does it say 20? It should say 3506. I don't know, it doesn't matter. Antipsychotic drugs are called antipsychotic drugs for a good reason. They diminish the symptoms of schizophrenia. Okay, so again, for those of you who haven't taken psychopathology, the notion here is that sort of a classic idea here is that there's two kinds of disorders, and it doesn't really say that in the DSM anymore, but there's psychotic disorders and neurotic disorders. It's more of a Freudian idea. But the big thing about psychotic disorders is that you're not reality testing. Quote, I want to call the other ones neurotic disorders, which nobody uses anymore, but if you want to call it that, those are things where you have a problem, but you still realize how the universe works. Right? So if you have problems with, I don't know, you're like a phobia. People that have phobias, they're irrational fears, and people that have a phobia, for example, know that it's irrational. They're afraid of sharks. Right? My friend Bianca, who's afraid of sharks and has never seen one in her life, but she's deathly afraid of shark, and if you say the word shark, you can actually watch the blood drain out of her face. She's from Rocky Harbor, Newfoundland. There's no sharks there. But she knows it's ridiculous that she's afraid of sharks. She's reality testing. A psychotic person, and typically we hear we're talking about, in this case, schizophrenia, isn't reality testing. They don't understand how the world works anymore. Right? And if you think of the movie A Beautiful Mind, while not a great depiction of schizophrenia, though auditory hallucinations don't make good movies, so they use visual hallucinations. But a lot of classic examples in that movie of someone being, in that case, having paranoid schizophrenia. So that's what we're talking about here, schizophrenia, which, again, for those of you that don't know, is not multiple personality disorder or dissociative identity disorder, whatever the hell they're calling it now. It's, and we'll talk about what the symptoms are in a second, but it's about reality testing. It's one of the biggest things. So there's two sets of symptoms, broadly, of schizophrenia. They're what are called negative symptoms and positive symptoms. So negative symptoms are things like their withdrawal. It's having less than normal of something. That's why it's negative. These are all bad. It's not like a value thing, negative and positive. The negative part just means that it's you're having less of something. Things like being catatonic, which is, you know, sitting in a corner, rocking back and forth, that kind of thing. Just general social withdrawal. Going, you know, sort of stepping out of society if you want or whatever. Positive symptoms are when you have more of something or something that you would normally have. So, for example, delusions of grandeur. So a lot of times people that have paranoid schizophrenia will think that they are somehow special. That's what a delusion of grandeur is. So, and I mean really special. Like they believe, and they truly believe, that they are Jesus or Napoleon or that they have the ability and they have been chosen by the aliens to speak for them. Nobody ever has delusions of just being okay, right? It's not like, I really think I'm another guy who's roughly the same as me. That never seems to go on. Right, that's called pretending. It's an entirely different thing. Here we're talking about people, usually delusions of grandeur, often tied in with paranoia. So if you believe that the aliens have chosen you to speak for them, you're probably paranoid that the Men in Black and Fox Mulder and Scully are going to come and get you. Right? And everybody else might be an agent. Or you might not want the aliens to choose you, so you're paranoid about the aliens finding out that you know that they can communicate with you. Okay? And it is kind of funny in a way. I'll tell you about a case in a second that happened to me. I didn't actually get schizophrenia. It's not something you just get and it goes away. But I know someone who did, who developed it. This often also ties in then with hallucinations. These are almost always auditory. That's why I said beautiful mind, they use visual. They kind of had to. If he was just hearing voices in his head, which he was, you wouldn't really know. Well, you'd know right away he was schizophrenic. I'm spoiling the movie now, but it's 10 years old. He's a paranoid schizophrenic who won a Nobel Prize. They used visual. Like I said, it makes a lousy movie to have auditory hallucinations. But almost everyone has auditory. There are cases with visual, but it's really rare. People originally thought, for example, when LSD came out that, we can use this to get an idea of what schizophrenia is like, but you don't tend to have auditory hallucinations with LSD. You tend to have visual hallucinations. Not nearly the same. So actually hearing voices, and not the running monologue we all have in our head, but actual voices of other people and entities. Perhaps Jesus talking to you, or perhaps the aliens talking to you, and we can go on. Okay? So this kind of thing. All right? So those are some of the symptoms. There's different kinds of schizophrenia, but the classic is what's called paranoid schizophrenia, and that's what I'm describing here. So, and I'll go through this, before I talk about this, I'll tell you about a really nice example, and this is when I was working as a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Western Ontario in the mid-90s. There was a guy in the lab who was from Russia. Russia was a newly free country, yada, 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 ever exciting, no more communists. So people were starting to apply to come over to North America to do research, And this guy had done a PhD, and he wanted to come do a postdoc in the lab, and that was really interesting because we thought, wow, give the guy an opportunity, right? So I was talking with the guy whose lab it was, and we decided, yeah, let's give this guy a shot. It's kind of cool. It seems like he's done some interesting work, has some ideas. So he shows up, and at first, he just seems weird. But it's weird, like, you think, well, you don't want to be a jerk because you think to yourself, well, I bet it's because he's from another country. And it's one different than us, so it's probably just that. So the fact that he didn't bathe very often or clean his clothes, which, by the way, are often telltale signs of schizophrenia, we just thought, well, he's, it's different over there. They stand in line for stuff. They just don't have things. So maybe it's just that. He was very quiet. A lot of withdrawal, so very quiet. But he seemed to be doing his work. And then one day he comes up to me, and we'll call him Alex. I will not use his real name. We'll call him Alex. And Alex comes up to me, and he says, first of all, I heard that he was sitting in, somebody showed you, this young woman, this guy, by the way, was 38 years old. And this woman, who was probably 22, 23, working in this other person's lab, she was working late one night. She said, let's go get something to eat. He took this the wrong way. Now, this happens. A lot, men are idiots, and a lot of times whenever women are nice to us, we think, well, they probably want to have sex with us. So, because that's how our brains work. But, so we figure, when he figures that this is his girlfriend, we all thought, oh, he just doesn't understand our culture, he took it the wrong way, nice-looking 23-year-old woman. Yeah, it's just, he screwed up and everything will be fine. Then it turns out he's sitting in her office one night at 10 o'clock at night when she walks in. Sitting there, waiting for her, calling her his girlfriend. So she left, which was the sensible move, it seems to me. And at this point, his hygiene is getting so bad that on the 8th floor of the social science building at the University of Western Ontario, you knew when Alex was around because you could smell it. And I'm not kidding. Pretty bad. So what ends up happening is I'm taking a pigeon and I'm putting it in a bus. That's before that. He comes to my office, and I kind of ran the lab. And he says, David, we have problems. And I said, yeah, we do. And I was going to tell him, I thought he was going to say that, no one liked him and all this stuff. And I was literally opening the drawer of my desk to pull out a stick of deodorant and say, you should start, first of all, by using this. I really was about to do that. He said, You broke me with Andrea. Again, changing her name to protect her. I said, I what? With a who now? So I closed the thing. I thought, oh, this isn't about that. He said, yes, you broke me with her. I said, oh, like you broke. I don't think you guys were a couple, were you? No, she's my girlfriend. And then she broke with me. I said, well, yeah. He said, we should have discussion. He said, uh-huh. And why would that be? Because you broke me with her. Be with her. I said, well, I don't even know her. I know her to say hello. I walk by her. She's in the other guy's lap. He said, well, we should have discussion. And I know you did because I heard your thoughts. Yep. No, the thing is, I thought, again, he has not much command in English. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, it's probably he meant he overheard me say something. Because you don't think someone has paranoid schizophrenia, even when they have every single sign looking at you. Because it's not something, it's 1%, between 1% and 3% of people will develop this. It's a pretty uncommon disorder. So I went and talked to this girl and I said, hey, what do they call her? Andrea? I almost used her real name there. You know about Alex, right? She said, oh no. I said, there's nothing. She said, of course. I said, good, that's all I wanted to know. So he comes in and I'm putting a pigeon in the box. Because I was working on animal timing experiments. I put this pigeon in the Skinner box. I turn around, he's right behind me. So I turn around and say, yeah? When are we having a meeting? I said, we're not, man. There's nothing there. Nothing happened. I don't know her. And she apparently says that you have no relationship with her. And I tend to believe her because she, you know. And he goes, a weird, evil Russian laugh. And then he says, you are part of it, aren't you? I said, part of what? Part of conspiracy. And I went, oh, crap. Now I know what it is. I was real, and I actually did exactly the opposite of what you should do. I confronted him, and I yelled at him, and I threatened to hit him. You know, like, be a man, you son of a bitch. The girl has no interest in you. She's half your age. Blah, 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 blah. I shouldn't have done that. It was completely wrong. But it was part of the thing about these disorders is they're not just disturbing to the person, they're disturbing to others. And this really is disturbing to interact with somebody like this. And I never thought I would react that way. And at that point, then I ran downstairs to the computer lab. I got on a computer. I emailed my buddy over doing a PhD in engineering. And I said, we're going to the grad club now. And he replied, because he was always on his computer, it's 11:30. I said, I think it's open already. And we went and we drank all afternoon and I was freaked out. This blows over. I'm starting to think maybe he's nuts, but you know, 2 weeks later, he shows up, and the guy whose lab I'm running, he shows up in his house, like outside his house, staring in the window. And then he let the whole conspiracy theory out that he had about how, because he was an immigrant, he had a chip implanted in him by the government secretly, and we could all see through his clothes with our X-ray vision. The chip implanted, by the way, is a classic, and that's why I knew in the movie Beautiful Mind, as soon as the chip was implanted, I took a piece of paper and I wrote paranoid schizophrenia. My wife said, oh, I'm just spoiling the movie and I don't want to do it for you. So I'm just writing this down to show you I figured it out earlier because I'm bad that way. So the chip in the arm, classic sort of thing, delusion people have. He ended up being given the choice, either go to the hospital or we put you on a plane and you fly back to, well, his family had moved to Israel. We went and found somebody who spoke Russian down in the history department, my old history prof, and we said, can you call his mom? She lives in Israel. And explain what's going on. Calls the mom. Mom's got paranoid schizophrenia. She's doing exactly the same thing. She believes all, the whole thing. So this is what paranoid schizophrenia is. He apparently still writes the guy who he used to work for, whose lab I used to run. Now and then, when is our paper coming out? Never. He actually did some decent work. The weird thing is, a lot of times, people's abilities are retained in specific domains, even though they are schizophrenic. For example, I've seen a great case of someone who's thought that aliens were controlling their mind. Guy was an electrical engineer, could draw a wiring diagram that would work, it wouldn't do anything, of the mind control device. So we could still draw resistors and transistors and all these other things. This beautiful circuit diagram of something that wouldn't do anything. Pretty amazing. So that's what it is. It's not just that people are eccentric and weird. It's a real disorder. Yeah?
Do Wouldn't calling parents be not the right thing to do, because isn't schizophrenia from one of the parents? That there has to be.
There's clearly a genetic component to it. It was the thing is, we had to put the guy in hospital because he was taken over to the hospital, University Hospital Western.
Okay.
We could actually see from the lab where the psych ward was, and we used to like look over. I wonder if he's there. But it was, 800 meters away. There's no way we could see it. But it was really the only thing we could do, because he couldn't stay in Canada anymore, because he wouldn't be able to work anymore. So he had to go home and be with his mom. So it was really, and we thought, well, call his mom, say he's sick. And, we did put him on a plane. We took him to the airport, put him on a plane. He had somebody with him to make sure he had taken his pills at that point, too. It was all we could do, because there was no way we could keep him. And I do wonder what happened to the guy. But after that, we started being a little bit more on the lookout for people. We should have seen it. We were all trained psychologists. We may have been working in animal cognition, but we all certainly knew this stuff, but we didn't, because you never think you're going to run into somebody. And you look back and you go, oh yeah, that. Okay. So this is the kind of thing I'm talking about. It's disturbing, and it's a real disorder. It's not just somebody being, eccentric. It's not, well, Einstein sometimes didn't wear socks. Yeah, but he knew how the universe worked. In fact, I think he invented it. So these drugs, then, are designed simply to control the symptoms of this. They're not a cure, they're a control. Another name for them is neuroleptic, which technically means clasping the neuron. And in a way, that's what they do. Figuratively, they stop dopamine neurons, in essence. Sometimes we hear them called major tranquilizers, as compared to benzodiazepines and barbiturates, which would be minor tranquilizers. Now, the reason is they put you out, right? It's not really an appropriate name, though, because they're nothing like these at all. They also have no reinforcing effects. Like I said, they're blocking dopamine. They're actually going to make reinforcement less likely. Whereas benzodiazepines and barbiturates operate in your reinforcement system, they feel good. There's no feel good from these drugs. So it's really a lousy name, but you'll hear it now and then. Right? The most useful classification of the drugs themselves is typical versus atypical antipsychotic drugs. Typical ones, some classics here, chlorpromazine, promazine, haloperidol, things like that. Okay? Those are the older ones, the newer ones, the atypicals. The best example here is probably clozapine. You see more people now getting atypicals versus typicals, but typicals, everybody really knows that they work. Atypicals, there's a potential problem with them, which I'll talk about shortly. So these are newer. These are late 80s, early 90s. Historically, a guy named, and I talked about this, Laborie, a French physician, tried antihistamines on people with schizophrenia, and basically it kind of worked. So he realized it was some sort of problem with too much of some neurotransmitter, and kept trying for different neurotransmitters until it worked with anti-dopamine drugs. They're administered orally, typically, so take a pill. Or a depot injection, which is... The problem with depot injections, they're a great idea. You put a little bladder, basically, in the person, and you inject it once a month, and then it slowly releases. The problem is, anybody who has paranoid schizophrenia, convincing them to have an operation where they have something even just below their skin, they already are paranoid about things, they might rip it out. Right? So it's not nearly as common, though it's a great idea, because if you can get it done, then you just have to do a little depot injection once a month, once every couple of weeks, rather than making sure they keep taking their pills. Yeah?
Are antipsychotics, unpleasant to take, because schizophrenics never seem to stay?
They are very unpleasant to take, yeah. Yeah, and we'll go over why. Think about this. They block dopamine. Your reward system runs on dopamine. Life suddenly has no fun. Yeah, you'll hear a lot of people that have schizophrenia say that they go off their meds. They got the meds now and then just to enjoy eating, for example, or have a sex drive again. Yeah. crosses the barriers. It's absorbed very slowly, which is great because this is being used as something to control a disorder. Just like when we think about an analgesic, we want slow absorption. We give it orally because we want a really big therapeutic window. And it's once it goes through the brain and is used, anything else is completely broken down by the metabolism and it's peed out. And it's not like there's, what's the word I'm looking for? Metabolites that are poisonous or anything like that. That's a good thing. How do these work? They block dopamine receptors. It's that simple. That's what they do. They especially block a certain kind of dopamine receptor called a D2 dopamine receptor. There is actually a direct relationship between the effectiveness and D2 binding. And the correlation is almost 1.00. And I'll show you a graph in a second. If you ever collect data like that, people will probably think you're faking it. It's so beautiful. This is one of the cases where people say, well, you hear people say, you know, it's just socially constructed. And all we're doing is we're taking people that are eccentric and medicating them. Then why does this graph show up like that? You know. It also blocks other things, acetylcholine, serotonin, and histamine receptors, but not nearly as effectively as it blocks the D2 receptors, and it seems like the blocking of D2 receptors is the important variable when you look at the ED50 for these drugs. It alters GABA and various peptides, so we've got it messing with other neurotransmitter systems too. It blocks norepinephrine receptors and causes an increase in norepinephrine synthesis, which kind of balances it out. Here's a graph. Look at that. That's pretty. Now, they are log scales. Here we have average dose for controlling schizophrenia. In other words, this is your ED50. And here we have binding to dopamine receptor. And here we have drugs. And here we have straight line. That's pretty. Right? It's pretty clear that it's a dopamine issue. People used to talk about the dopamine hypothesis in schizophrenia. It's dopamine. That's the problem. If this graph does not convince you of that, nothing will. So the more, you know, you need more to block more dope. Oh, look, straight line. And again, this is a log scale, as you can see. So that's a pretty good indication that this is nothing but a dopamine problem. Right? Where does it come from? That's another question. But neurochemically, it's a dopamine issue. How they work? Oops, sorry.
A lot of times when they give Haldol, they also give Ativan as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
The immediate effect versus the long term.
Yeah, and in fact, I know in hospitals they call them vitamin H and vitamin A.
Yeah, or
yeah.
The snowball.
Yeah. Yeah, and what you're looking for there is the immediate effect versus the. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Ativan will work right away. Yeah. It also, well, you'll go to sleep. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, oh yeah. Key brain regions here, big surprise here, we know this runs on dopamine, the mesolimbic dopamine system. You can sort of think of it this way, and is that there's too much reinforcement in these people's lives when their dopamine receptors aren't being blocked. So everything they do gets reinforced. Right? The hallucinations probably come from too much dopamine. But you think about all the odd behavior might come from the fact that every single thing they do, there's dopamine rushing in their mesolimbic dopamine system. That's a reward system. It's blocking that. Why do people not want to take these drugs? This is where fun happens. That's why you don't want to take these drugs. Life stops having any meaning. You don't have any more hallucinations. They're gone. You stop being paranoid. And food doesn't taste good anymore. Nothing's funny. Nothing's fun. Life sucks. Also, there are key brain regions as far as the dopamine receptors, the nigrostriatal region, which is called that. That's Latin for black stripe, because if you stain it, it stains with black and white stripes, basically. Niagara striatum is important in smooth movement. And the problem here is that, in fact, Parkinson's patients don't have enough dopamine in their niagara striatal system. So when these drugs were first given, it was amazing what happened. When anti-schizophrenic, antipsychotic drugs were developed in the 1950s and early 60s, so we went from having psychiatric institutions filled with paranoid schizophrenic people to them all going, because it was like, they're fine now. Though, so that was one thing. The other thing that happened was people didn't quite know what doses to give people, and they give them too much, and then they end up looking like they have Parkinson's. It's called tardive dyskinesia. So it ends up they move like, I've got a friend with Parkinson's, and I mean, his hand shakes like that all the time. Very slow walking, kind of a shuffle kind of thing.
Right? Cold,
yeah, that's right. Whoops, sorry. The atypical antipsychotics have fewer side effects and also seem to work a little bit on the negative symptoms. The typical antipsychotics work pretty much solely on the positive symptoms. So you might still get a little bit of social withdrawal, these things, so you might have to deal with that some other way. It's the hallucinations, the paranoia, the delusions of grandeur. The atypicals don't seem to have, first of all, they work somewhat on the negative symptoms, but they also don't have nearly the side effects, the Parkinson's-like side effects. We don't really quite know yet why that is, and it's probably they have a little less effect in the niagara striatal area. That would make complete sense. And drugs that block a cholinergic, so acetylcholine receptors, stop Parkinson's symptoms, and so do atypical antipsychotics. They block cholinergic receptors. So it looks like that's what's going on here, that they're more targeting the reward system and doing less in the niagara striatum. Okay? Side effects. The worst symptoms are Parkinson's-like symptoms. It's called, again, tardive dyskinesia, D-Y-S, dyskinesia. The thing about tardive dyskinesia is that if you get the right dose, at least wait, does instead of dose. I don't know what that is. If you get the right drug in the right dose, you can deal with the Parkinson's-like symptoms. It involves finding the right drug and the right dose so people don't end up with these Parkinson's symptoms. People have problems with thermoregulation when they take these drugs, so they are either they sweat a lot, they're either hot or they're too cold, shiver a lot. People have been known to have seizures. That's usually with too much of the drug, right? But again, everybody's a little bit different, and that's why there's so many of these drugs on the market, and different ones are tried at different doses. Now, the atypicals can make your liver shut down. This you were wondering probably, why isn't everyone using atypical antipsychotics? They work more on negative symptoms, they don't have the Parkinson's-like effects, and they still work on the positive symptoms, and for a small number of people, it kills them. They were thought of as this panacea when they were come out, when clozapine, for example, came out in the late 80s. Everybody's like, yeah, it's clozapine. And then some people died. This, in fact, is exceedingly rare. It's really, really rare, but it's a real side effect. Right? In fact, it looks like it only seems to happen, this side effect, in people of Middle Eastern or maybe Mediterranean descent. It's some genetic thing. So if you had schizophrenia and you went into a emergency room, they wouldn't right away give you an atypical, first of all. But if they did give you an atypical and you were of, you know, Arab background, it's unlikely that they'd really do a lot of screening first, let's say that. Right? Or if you were Italian or Portuguese. It seems like Middle Eastern for sure, maybe Mediterranean. And there are drugs that only work on certain sets of people because of genetic differences. There are disorders that only certain sets of people get, like diseases. So this shouldn't be something weird and surprising. It's a little odd. And I did say probably because we don't really know this. It's exceedingly rare, but it is a real side effect. People did die from these drugs. This shouldn't surprise you if it slows everybody down. This is that whole idea of major tranquilizer. These drugs slow you down because, well, first of all, think of all those things it's blocking. Acetylcholine, you need that to move, right? It's messing with dopamine, things that not only help you move, but also make life interesting and fun. It's messing with serotonin, right? Really key brain chemistry things. So what's happening here is people just slow down, so do animals. This is the idea of tranquilizer. And in fact, many times people will sleep 20 hours a day on these drugs, which makes it difficult because the idea here is you're trying to help people. You're giving them the drug. You're trying to help them integrate back into society. And it's hard to hold down a job when you have two choices. Either don't take your medication and you hear voices, or do take your medication and you're always slow and sleepy. Right? That said, there are quite a number of people that have paranoid schizophrenia that can control the drugs and contribute to society positively, no problem. It does happen. There are dissociative effects, so what you learn on the drug, you won't remember off the drug and vice versa. And this is also true with, say, rats learning a maze. Right? Reduces sex drive. Does this surprise anybody? Nothing feels good anymore. It's blocking the system that rewards you. Of course you're going to have less sex drive. There's really no big withdrawal to speak of. I mean, except that you go back to being schizophrenic. But that's not really a withdrawal symptom. Of course, these have no street value whatsoever. There's no fun in them. There's no one saying, hey, want to buy some chlorpromazine? Doesn't happen. There's no fun in them. Right? And this is why I don't like the term major tranquilizer, because unlike, you know, Valium actually feels good to take. It slows you down, it makes you tired, but you get a bit of a, oh yeah, that's not bad. That's feeling good. You don't get that with this stuff. It's just like you get, oh, the voices are gone, and now I'm going to go to sleep because life has no meaning.
Dave.
Yeah.
If schizophrenics have too much dopamine, What is the therapeutic range of dopamine then?
How do you mean?
Like,
oh, what's the right level?
If we have enough dopamine to make our lives feel good, but not so much that we're hallucinating. So
yes.
With schizophrenics, can they not have that range?
Well, that's basically what you're trying to do with the drug. You try to titrate it, exactly. You're trying to get the right dose and the right drug. The problem is that the system's going to adjust too, right? There's a set point that happens with most neurochemistry, and it's what you're built with. So they're built wrong. I mean, if you have a relative or a friend with schizophrenia, don't take this the wrong way. They're built wrong. They're hooked up wrong. So their body says you don't need so much dopamine, but they actually do, right? You need less dopamine, but their body actually thinks that they need, you know, a great deal, right? We know they need less. But the thing is, it seems they only need less in the reward system is the key place. It's not so important like in the nigrostriatum, because atypical antipsychotics wouldn't work if that was the case. And it's also the case with, and it seems like it's a particular receptor. So it's not just dopamine, it's D2 receptors as well. And there's 4 or 5 kinds of dopamine receptors, D1 to D4, and then I think there's a D, that's the other one. Oh, it's another one of those receptors that, it's like a kappa receptor, like that one that for opiates that is for a bunch of other things, so it's also a dopamine receptor. So I mean, I think. So it's one of these cases where it would be hard. This would involve likely something like, once we know the genes, this will involve genetic therapy, I think. I think that's how you will actually cure it. But knowing that is pretty complicated still. We know the problem. The problem is the D2 receptors. That's pretty clear. And when you hear people say that it's all about labeling and it's all about the rich telling the poor homeless people that they're... Just show them the graph. You know, that's sort of the take I have. But I'll tell you something, a vast majority, I shouldn't say that, a lot of people you see homeless on the streets in big cities or even the place like this have paranoid schizophrenia and it's uncontrolled. And they're unmedicated. That's why you see people walking down the street yelling. They're yelling at the voices in their heads. Yeah.
Are any typical medications synthetic, man-made, or
they all are.
They all are.
Yeah. Yeah, they all are. They're designer drugs. Yep. Yep. I mean, you know, to be blunt and not meaning to be mean to anybody, these are people that we would call crazy. Right? That's what we're talking about here. These aren't people that just have a failure to commit. They aren't people that, you know, it's not people that have minor psychological problems. These aren't people that have a problem with time management. These are people that think differently than you and I. The amazing thing is that actually the drugs have done wonders because they've changed the world as far as psychiatric disorders go. Psychiatric institutions used to be full of paranoid schizophrenics, and there was nothing you could do. What did they used to try? They used to try talking therapy. Think about this. You're going to talk to someone who has a disorder that makes them think that everyone is in a conspiracy against them. Do you think they're going to listen to you? Probably not. Therapy that happens now is after people get on the drugs, there's therapy, and it's therapy for social interaction, and it's therapy to convince people to keep taking their medication. That's the important thing here. Right? One of the real problems that's happened in the last few years is there's been a real kind of push and pull between there are groups that are families of schizophrenics. There's a group called Ontario Friends of Schizophrenics, for example. There's a push and pull between them and people that are sort of, let's call them radical patient advocates that want people to always be able to refuse to take medication. Now, the problem here is when a schizophrenic refuses to take his medication or her medication, they're going to get schizophrenia. It doesn't go away. This isn't a cold. And this isn't a cure. And the Ontario Friends of Schizophrenics have often said things like, would you let a diabetic say, no, I'm not taking my insulin? Well, no, of course you wouldn't. So that's where this push and pull happens between the idea of sort of individual rights, and schizophrenics have rights, of course they do, and the rights of... They're also their right to life. I mean, can they actually make a decision when they're having these symptoms? And if you aren't reality testing when you're having the symptoms, I don't know that you actually can make a choice. Right? And a lot of people, when you're giving them a pill, will say, I'm not taking that. You're part of the conspiracy. You're trying to control me. Well, yeah, sort of, so you can function in the world. Right? But yeah, talking therapy never is going to work. You can't talk someone out of paranoid schizophrenia. It's just not going to happen. Yeah?
I've heard that major life traumas can initiate the onset of schizophrenia.
Very often the case that, though, you should keep in mind that most of us that have a major life trauma don't develop schizophrenia, right? But oftentimes there is an onset. It's usually early 20s. Sometimes it's older than that, like with that guy that I knew there. What did I call him again? Alex. I got to remember what fake name I'm using this time. He was probably 38, 37. It's hard to say if he had it before, had, you know. But, yeah, oftentimes it's something either traumatic or, well, when we talk about marijuana, schizophrenics shouldn't be using any drugs other than antipsychotic drugs. They should not be playing with the weed, and especially the LSD, and anything that can possibly alter the way they perceive the world. It's a very bad idea. So yeah, it can happen, but it isn't always the case. A lot of cases are just people one day, to coin a phrase, go nuts. Yeah. And sometimes it develops in childhood, but sometimes very common for it to be late teens, early 20s. Very common. Now, I don't want to caution you about medical students' disease. Do you know about that, where you think you can diagnose things? Because you can't. So please be careful. If you have a friend who hasn't washed their hair in a couple of days and is a little withdrawn right now, maybe they're writing a paper. it's probably not that they've developed paranoid schizophrenia. They may be. If they start talking to you about the aliens and the voices in their heads, yeah, get them to a hospital. Right? But just because someone's disheveled at this time of year, we're going in the home stretch of the second term, everybody's a little disheveled. Right? Think of how it smelled in here when we walked in after that physics exam that was in here. Those guys are all schizophrenic now. You know. That's all I got on this. They're so easy to understand. Does anybody have any questions about it or anything besides, which was a great question? These drugs are too easy to understand. See, alcohol is complicated and fun. Antipsychotics are just no fun at all. So I think our best hope here is more and better drugs. I mean, that's... And eventually finding out what... I think that's our best hope for everything. But thank you. But also, I think that the key thing is trying to find out what the cause is. And that's something... It looks like it's genetic. But it's also the case that people that live in poorer, like lower socioeconomic status, have more schizophrenia. But they have more everything. That could be environment a lot. That could be... Could be drug-induced schizophrenia, which does happen. Remember I talked about amphetamine psychosis? It looks just like paranoid schizophrenia until the coke's out of your system, then you're fine. Yeah. You got anything? Because, I mean, that's... My God. It's like nothing. Oh, well. Sorry. I guess. Oh, by the way, the sign-up sheet is outside my door to sign up for your time to give your talk. If you have given me a paper idea, and I've approved it. Thanks. How did they...
There's cat and crying. Oh, these I say, don't leave me in your way. In a better day, and I wish you'll look my way.
This podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright, share alike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me, because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.